Well, the evangelist Glenn Scrivener has written a great book called The Air We Breathe. It should be something familiar to you because Dick wrote a review of it in the news sheet or the prayer news a few months ago. And in this book, or the title really comes from this, because what he's arguing is that things that we sort of assume as obvious, sort of values that we have in society, you know, where we are sort of pro-freedom, equality, compassion, all these sorts of things. He's arguing these things actually come from Christianity. It's actually quite unusual in history for those to be the values of a society. But we just don't notice that, just as we don't notice the air that we breathe. We don't sort of wake up in the morning and think, wow, this is amazing, I'm breathing. You know, just as a fish doesn't really notice the water that it's swimming in. We're so used to it, we don't notice it. And it was that sort of phrase, the air that we breathe, that came to mind when I came across a different book that comes from a little bit further ago, this book called Facing Grief by a guy called John Flavel. This was published in 1674. And it felt like he was breathing different air to our culture as he discusses how we should handle grief. The whole perspective, the assumptions seem very different. For example, he spends a lot of time talking about how you can grieve in the wrong way, that you can have wrong emotions. And that immediately sounds rather strange, I think, in our culture. Our culture says you should express your emotions, you should be true to yourself. How you feel is the real you. You know, you are your emotions. Well, Flavel looks at it slightly differently. And as he talks about grief, don't think that he sort of lived a cushioned life. He saw his parents imprisoned and effectively murdered as a result. He saw a child die. He saw three wives die. It wasn't all at once, it was concurrently. And he lost his livelihood in a very cruel way in something called the Great Ejection of 1662, which I won't take time to explain now. But, you know, Flavel isn't necessarily correct in everything that he says. So what we're going to do is go to Jesus. We want to look at the air that Jesus breathed, if you like, and a passage that Flavel bases his book on, that passage we read about the raising of the widow of Nain's son. And we're doing this so that we can find help in grief, in the pain of grief. And yes, the focus is on bereavement, but it applies really to any form of loss or trauma. Things at work, accidents, family situations. And the problem is that these things do happen. But so often we don't think about that till they do. And in some ways that's too late. It's much harder to make sense of grief when we're in the midst of grief. That's almost the wrong time to try and think about it. We need a sort of theology of grief before we get there. So if you like, what we're trying to do today is sort of preventative medicine to help us cope with grief, to prepare for what actually will be inevitable. And the first place I think we need to begin is with reality. Luke here confronts us with a funeral, with a large crowd from the town. The whole town is affected by this. And Luke here is talking about real events. There's actually a remarkable detail in this account because Jesus speaks to the woman first. As you meet this sort of funeral procession, Jesus speaks to the woman first and goes to the coffin second, which actually fits a very obscure detail of how funerals would occur in Galilee, the part of Israel that this was set in. It was the custom in this part of Israel for the women to walk in front of the coffin. In other places, it was the custom to walk behind. But in this place, Luke gets this right. She's not behind the coffin. And as Luke describes this scene, he draws out the sort of multiple tragedies here. He talks about there being, in verse 12, a dead person. Well, that's what you would expect at a funeral. But he goes on. The only son of his mother. And then he adds, and she was a widow. You see how he's sort of piling on the tragedy here. You've got a mother burying her son. That's the wrong way round, isn't it? What is worse than burying a child? And it's her only child, her only son. And it seems that he was a young man. It's not talking about a baby. He was someone cut off, if you like, in his prime, beyond the vulnerability of being a baby. And she was a widow, which meant there would be no more children. It meant she had no real status. She had no one to look after her and provide for her in the way things worked in that culture. There was no hope. You sort of feel the desperateness of her situation. Well, this is reality, isn't it? Welcome to our world. The Bible is always utterly realistic about human tragedy, about the horror, the brutality of our world. You know, one reason why sometimes people say don't like reading the Bible is when they start reading it, they say, well, I don't like all this stuff. There's all this war and sexual violence and dysfunctional families and all this. You know, it sort of really should be 18 rated, actually, I think, a lot of the Bible. But that's our world, isn't it? You know, if you're a dysfunctional family, the Bible's your book. You don't actually find any nice little perfect families in the Bible. Pretty much it's only dysfunctional ones. This is who it's written for. Because the Bible's not been written to be our teddy bear. It's been written to be our teacher. It's reality. Let me read you something that Flavel said that shows how his air was a little bit different to ours. I nearly choked when I read this because he's sort of responding to someone who's saying, look, the reason I find it so hard to deal with my grief is that it was all so sudden. This is his response. He says that the death of your relation was so sudden and surprising was much your own fault. He thought, hang on a minute, you can't say that. How can it be your fault? But what he means by this is not that somehow they've sort of killed their relative. What he means is be real. Death happens, and death happens unexpectedly. Be prepared for the unexpected. If you like it, in Donald Rumsfeld's words, it's a known unknown. Be real. These things happen, so don't be so surprised when it does actually happen. It's not just theoretical. These things do actually happen. We're in a fallen world. We're in a sin-cursed world. Death reigns. There is something terribly wrong with our world. It's not just how it is. When we've turned from our Maker, the one who gives us life, death is the result. If we truly believe that, is that the sort of air that you breathe, the assumption that you have? This is how someone commented recently about the difficulties young people face. They said this: young people are suffering not so much from worse experiences than their forebears as from a greater mismatch between their expectations and their experiences. You see, they're told that everything's fine, that they are fine, that the world is fine, that the world is there for them. But our culture is not being real. We're minimizing, we're ignoring problems. I think sometimes we overly shield children from the reality of pain. We're not being real to what the world and themselves are really like. You may have come across Philip Pullman's works. He's an author written in some ways for children. Someone would see himself as rather against Christianity. He was almost trying to sort of write an alternative to sort of C.S. Lewis. And particularly in the TV adaptation of his books, The Dark Materials, it was very interesting how he tries to deal with death, with the sort of hopelessness of death, And basically, the answer is tell stories, love people a bit more, and have some strange hope in some sort of bodiless afterlife. It's not reality. It's trying to sort of shield people from the horror and reality of the way it actually is. Another way our culture isn't being real is the way we're so often ruled by our feelings. In fact, feelings are reality, create reality. Your gender is what you feel. And feeling care, showing emotion, is the same as or even almost replaces actually giving care. You know, if you can show how much you care, that's what really counts. Not actually the reality of actual care that you give. It's about how much emotion you display. Well, Jesus is very different. His words are a different air because he goes to this widow and says, "Don't cry." Who does Jesus think he is? He's at a funeral. He's talking to the mother at the funeral and telling her not to cry. Effectively, he's saying, you've got the wrong emotions here. Jesus would have failed any counseling course at this point. Who does he think he is? Well, understand this. It's not that Jesus has something against emotion or somehow you're meant to sort of suppress emotion. That's not the point. No, Jesus has emotion in three dimensions, as we were thinking earlier. He has deeper emotions than us. His heart went out to this widow. His point here is that her emotions don't match reality. And you think, hang on, that sounds bizarre. She's got a dead son behind her. But that's sort of what I want to try and explain in the rest of this message. Why there was no need for her to cry in the light of the reality of who God is, who she is, and what God is doing. Jesus, if you like, is bringing a new reality here. Second thing that helps us, and really this is part of reality, is sovereignty, God's sovereignty. That means his complete rule and control over everything. And this is something hugely prominent in the air that Flavel breathes. God's complete control, ownership of everything. God holds the copyright of life. This is God's world to order how he pleases. It's not yours for what you want. And so it's a doctrine that really humbles us. It's basically telling us it's not about me. And our culture is constantly saying, it's all about you. No, it's not. This is God's world. And we see Jesus' sovereignty here over events. It's about 25 miles between Capernaum, where Jesus was before, and this town of Nain. And burials would often be very quick, within a day or so. So it's quite possible that when Jesus set out, this boy was alive. But he arrives at the exact right moment to meet this funeral party. A few minutes earlier or later, and he would have missed this procession. It's not random that Jesus was there at this moment. It was part of his plan. And even the boy's death was part of his plan. Whatever trial you are in, whatever grief there is, it is not fate. It is not random chance. It is ultimately what God has chosen. We rarely know why God has done that. Unless God tells us, we can't know. I don't know the mind of God. But there is comfort here if you trust this God, because you are not crying out to a sort of pitiless, impersonal universe, but you're crying out to your God and Maker, a person. And it's not wrong to cry out. It's not wrong to complain to God in our grief. It is wrong to complain about God. Listen to how a pastor called Tim Challies puts it. In 2020, his 20-year-old son died suddenly, just playing sport, and he just died. And this is what he says. He says, "By faith, I will accept Nick's death as God's will, and by faith accept that God's will is always good. I will grieve but not grumble, mourn but not murmur, weep but not whine. Early on, my wife and I realized that we were either going to trust God in this or we weren't. We adhere to Reformed theology. We believe strongly in God's sovereignty, and we profess it all the time. But listen to this. But throughout my life, God's sovereignty had almost invariably done what I wanted it to do. It's easy to trust in God, isn't it, when he does what you want? The question is, will we trust when it's not what we would have chosen? And there are very practical implications, I think, of taking God's sovereignty seriously. It means we don't need to rewrite history. We don't need to be overcome with regrets. Yes, we all do plenty that is wrong. But even that is not outside God's sovereignty and purpose. We don't also need to sulk. We don't need to be like a sort of angry toddler refusing to accept the situation. You can't alter what has happened through stubbornness. And if you are trying to do that, you are arguing with God. You are challenging his purpose. You are not God. It means we're not going to refuse comfort. You know, so determined to keep hold of grief that we refuse, push away any acts or words of comfort. It means we're not going to provoke grief. We're not going to wallow in it out of self-pity, almost delighting in being miserable. Maybe we almost can do that as a way to almost try and atone for what we feel we've done wrong, or maybe sometimes to make other people feel sorry for you. You know, see how badly treated you've been. Don't provoke grief. Flavel has a great phrase. He says, grief is like a lion. It loves to play with us before it destroys us. I guess I see that, what our cat Hagrid does, yeah. And it's a great picture, isn't it? He's saying, don't sort of play with grief. Don't provoke it. Don't deliberately open wounds. Pictures, memories that aggravate grief. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's a right remembering, but it's not to aggravate grief. It's not almost to make us sad. Grief is to be our servant. It's a way of expressing emotion. It's not our master. This is how a lady called Catherine Campbell describes it, a child of hers had died. She says this, grief is also very lonely and selfish. It condemns you to solitary confinement. It makes you feel as if no one else is suffering like you, even though there are others who are grieving just as much. I began to look on grief like a great big coat that I picked up every day and chose to wear, not daring to dispose of it in case the one I was grieving for might think I didn't care anymore. Grief becomes your hiding place, but it doesn't keep you safe. Instead, it seems to shut the door on hope. And worst of all, grief becomes your accuser, as it is fertile ground in which feelings of guilt can flourish. Guilt was my enemy, dogging my footsteps. You see, the answer to that is to trust in God, to hold on to him, to trust in his goodness, in his grace. Because God here is doing something wonderful for this widow. There is a bigger purpose going on. And it's a purpose of grace. This is God's giving that we don't deserve. All the initiative here is with Jesus. The widow didn't approach Jesus and ask for help. He went to her. He walked 25 miles to Nain for her. And it's interesting, just the context here, where you've got this account of the centurion. You've got a man who has position, who has power, who has relative wealth, compared to this woman, this widow, who is poor and powerless. But both equally are in receipt of God's grace. Neither of them deserved this. Neither of them were owed this. They didn't deserve Jesus to do this for them. Well, that's very different to the air we breathe, isn't it? If there is a characteristic of our age, it is the idea of entitlement. I deserve something good. I'm entitled to a happy life, a successful life. I'm entitled to be provided for. That's the lie of our age. And in grief, we can give way to Satan's lies. He can say, well, you know, you really don't deserve this. You know, why isn't God doing this for you? As if God owes you. As if God is there to prop your life up and do what you want like a magic genie. Why should God listen to your prayers? God isn't obliged to. He is God. You are not. He owes you nothing. Whereas you owe him everything. This widow was poor and powerless. In one sense, you could say she was a sort of victim. But she didn't deserve Jesus to do this because she was a sort of victim. Having suffered doesn't mean you deserve something from God. Again, it's so different to the air we breathe today. But having suffered doesn't mean God owes you. This widow was a sinner like everyone else. Everyone is guilty before God. All of us haven't loved and obeyed God as we should. And God is the one person who is entitled to something. He is entitled to our obedience. And it is sin why we are ultimately in a suffering world. Now, the particular suffering may not be due to some particular sin of ours. That's not how it works. It's not that this widow somehow deserved this in a particular way. There is such a thing as innocent suffering. But what I am saying is that God owes none of us a trouble-free life. In fact, we should be astonished at whatever blessing we do see and enjoy. Flavel points out that the wrong sort of grief leads us to so focus on our grief that we fail to notice God's other mercies, his goodness, his provision. He says this, a cloud dwells upon all other comforts. This affliction has so embittered your soul that you taste no more in any other earthly comfort than in the white of an egg. A great turn of phrase. So we deserve nothing. This widow deserved nothing. Yet, what do we read? Jesus' heart went out to her. This deep emotion. His intestines contorted in care and compassion for her. He has more pity on her, actually, than she had for her son. If you think you're entitled, you miss the wonder of God's grace. God doesn't have to be like this, but he is like this. This is the sort of person he is. We don't deserve this, but he's the sort of God that loves to give. And see how individual this is. Jesus doesn't enter Nain and say, oh, right, there's a funeral, in some sort of general way. He sees a woman. He sees a mother. He sees a widow. He sees her need. It's interesting, when the boy is raised, what does he do? Give him back to his mother. She needed him. That was Jesus' concern. Jeremy Marshall, someone who at the moment is dying of cancer, writes of this passage, "We are utterly insignificant, yet the maker of the universe makes a beeline for us in our suffering." That's grace. And there's hope, because Jeremy Marshall goes on to say, Jesus here is standing in the way of death. You know, the one thing you can't stop is a funeral, isn't it? But here, Jesus is telling death to stop. Nain is on a hill, and death is carrying this body downwards. But Jesus touches the coffin. It would have been an open coffin. And he tells this man to get up. Not simply to sit up, but to rise from the dead. And the funeral procession turns around and goes back to the city. So if you like, Jesus puts death into reverse gear. And that's quite impressive, isn't it? It's a sort of ultimate healing. And, you know, do you sort of think, well, I wish I was there. I wish I could have seen that. Or I wish Jesus would do that in my experience, in my loss, in my trauma. Put things in reverse. Well, at the risk of being misunderstood, can I put it like this? What Jesus does here is actually a bit rubbish compared to what he can do for you now. You see, it was like people that Jesus healed. It was a temporary fix. It prolonged their life, but they still died in the end. This boy would go on one day to die. It was a temporary fix. There was something more that Jesus was coming to do. It's one reason why obsession with healing and even some of the sort of attempts to sort of raise the dead, I think, are so misguided. It's you're going after something that's a bit rubbish. Jesus has got something so much better. And the people understand this. They look at Jesus and they say, boy, God's come to do something here. There's something greater going on. And this is what Jesus himself says in response to the people from John the Baptist. He's saying that these miracles are really a sign of something greater. They're a sign of all that he's coming to do. God is doing a new thing, to quote Isaiah. So in other words, the incarnation is not enough. Healing is not enough. Raising the dead is not enough. Jesus needs to die. That is how death is going to be defeated. The route to victory over death is via the cross. It is on the cross that Jesus suffers grief like no other. All the weight of sin and suffering from humanity across history are heaped upon this one man. And why does he do that? He says he does that so that he would be able to say to this widow and to you, don't cry. Because he exhausted the power of death on the cross, which means he was raised to resurrection life. That's better than what this boy knew. It is a physical life. It is a bodily life. But it is a different kind of life that is incapable of dying, incapable of the suffering that goes with it. So it's not a return to the status quo. It's a whole new form of life. And what the incredible message is this, that Jesus shares that future with all who trust in him. His resurrection can become yours. We have resurrection bodies in a new creation. If you missed the start of the service, you missed something very wonderful because we read these words of the new creation. God will be there. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. In other words, the answer to grief is not denying reality, but Jesus changing reality. So he can say to this woman, don't cry, because your son is alive. He can say to us, don't cry, because there is an end to pain. There is an end to the pain of grief. There is hope. And that hope in the future means that in the present, we can get on with our other duties. Grief doesn't need to paralyze us. But understand, it's not just all in the future. There is help in the present. It is not simply about this hope for the future. Jesus is giving help in the present. And that's where we finish this morning. Jesus is enough. In a way, this is the essence of what it means to be a Christian. It means Jesus is worth it, whatever it costs. To become a Christian is really to surrender to Jesus, that he is worth more than anything. His smile matters more than anything. This is how Flavel puts it. Lord, give me Christ and deny me whatever else you please. That's quite a statement. Pardon my sins, save my soul, and in order to both, unite me to Christ, and I will never repine or open my mouth. Do what you will with me. Let me be friendless. Let me be childless. Let me be poor. Let me be anything rather than a Christless, graceless, hopeless soul. That's a high view of Christ. But now think of this widow. Jesus says to her, don't cry before her son is raised. He doesn't even tell her what he's going to do. She had no idea Jesus was going to touch that coffin and raise her son to life. But in that moment, he was telling her to trust him without having an answer. In that moment, Jesus was saying, I'm enough. Picture it like this. In this sort of account, we're seeing sort of normal history compressed into a moment. You know, the way that the son dies, meets Jesus, the son is alive, and there's no more grieving. Well, we are in the time, if you like, when Jesus says, don't cry, but we are waiting for that final resurrection. We're in that intermediate time. But in this moment, we can say Jesus is enough now. And that helps us with something that, slightly bizarrely, Flavel doesn't really address. It's an amazing amount of detail he gives on a whole load of other things, but there's actually something, an elephant in the room, I think, he just doesn't really address. And it's this. Much of his argument is finding comfort in the resurrection life that the dead person can enjoy. And there absolutely is comfort there. But you can only have that confidence for those who have clearly trusted in Christ now. And that isn't everyone. Ultimately, we can't be certain of everyone's eternal future. We don't know exactly how people die. And that, in the end, is something for Jesus. That is something to leave with Jesus, confident in Abraham's word that the judge of all the earth will do right. In other words, our hope is in Christ. It is in all that is found in him, not in being certain of where the dead have gone. So to sort of say, well, I'll be happy if I know has gone to heaven. No, that's wrong. Christ is enough, whatever. Christ, Jesus' focus here is with the living. His concern is for the widow. He addresses her need before dealing with the dead son. And she finds comfort in Jesus without knowing the future of her son. Jesus is so amazing. He puts everything right. That's what we see constantly in his ministry. We don't always understand how, just as this widow didn't understand. But he is promising a future where there is no more mourning or crying or pain, where there are no more regrets, no more grief, where we will be satisfied with all that God has done. And we can begin to know that comfort now. For the Lamb at the center of the throne, that's Jesus, will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Now that in some ways is talking about the future. But Jesus is our shepherd now. He leads us to living water now. He wipes tears away now. There is comfort in the present. So the key question this morning is not actually about those who have died. That's out of our hands. That, in a sense, if I can put it like this, is God's problem. We shouldn't dwell on that. Our concern should be with the living. That's where Jesus is addressing his concern constantly. And that means with you. Where is your trust? With your hope? It needs to be in Jesus, the resurrection and the life. No more grief is a promise to those who have surrendered their life to Jesus, received his forgiveness, and share in his resurrection life. Is that you? That's the challenge to us this morning.